to turn our attention to media critic time. I love this segment. Dick Weiss, former editor, longtime editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, 30 years there. Spent 20 years at the Metro section. He took the buyout. He took the buyout two buyouts ago, I believe. Not this last buyout, the buyout before.
That's right.
Okay. You also run a website, weissright.com, weissright.com, and he's here every Monday. Welcome to the show.
Great to be back.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
All right, good. Are you a pumpkin pie or an apple pie?
I'm an apple pie guy.
Really?
And I don't like cranberries.
I like the cranberry. I like the gelled, the real cranberries out of the can with the little ridges.
They're real when they're
in the
can?
Real.
Yeah, the real ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Not those ones where they go to this produce aisle and they...
Do you like the yams with the marshmallows?
I've never been a yam guy or a sweet potato guy.
No, me neither.
No. But pecan. I'm a pecan pie guy. Mm. All right. big news of the day that we are no longer number one in the murder capital of the world.
Yes.
We are now number two.
Yes.
Okay. I find this interesting because this is last year this story broke right after the World Series. Big story. Now the RCGA is coming out and others are saying, hey, wait a minute, these are bogus stats. Why do we put so much credence in this one study if how we know that they are comparing apples to oranges when they look at all these different cities?
Well, that's a good question. I think the word of the day today is canard,
mm-hmm.
a false and misleading story. You were talking about this a canard in the last hour, and
yes.
Now we have another one.
Yes.
And this, at one time, a small organization out of Kansas was taking crime statistics that were pulled together, compiled by the FBI, and putting its own interpretation and spin on those figures and labeling cities as most dangerous or safest.
Right.
And the FBI had put out an advisory saying that you cannot make city-by-city comparisons based on these numbers. They're for other purposes, and this organization did as well. And then they, in a great and inspired public relations move, noticed that their top two cities that they had deemed most dangerous happened to be playing in the World Series. So they released, they sent their press release out at World Series time.
Right.
So that... the Associated Press and other newspapers across the country would have an angle.
Right.
And it said, you know, while these two cities are celebrating a great World Series, they also happen to be the most dangerous. And so that's how this thing got legs. Well, since then, Congressional Quarterly purchased this company. And so now these this organization kind of has the imprimatur, the credibility of Congressional Quarterly, which is has a good reputation. And when the RCGA knew this was going to come around again and probably that St. Louis would be near the tippy top once again, they went to Congressional Quarterly and said, please, if you're going to produce this, you need to make a point that the FBI says this is inappropriate. And they really got the bums rush when they went there. And it wasn't just the RCGA that went. It wasn't just Fleischman Hillard that went. It was a national organization of reporters, journalists, who report on crime, who also said this was a canard.
Right.
And they said, it's your problem. Go fight crime.
Right.
And the interesting thing about this is that Congressional Quarterly is owned by the Poynter Institute. The Poynter Institute is the last word in journalistic credibility. They teach journalists to be ethical.
Right.
And so this may fall at some point. I'm not even sure if the people at Poynter are aware of what's going on. It may be beneath their radar. But at some point, they'll become aware of it, and I think they will be embarrassed.
Here's what I don't understand. We all agree that it's a bogus survey. It's not, no basis in fact. We have the FBI saying so. Even our own intelligence tells us when you only take the inner city core and not the region, it's different. And the FBI says you just can't do it with these numbers we give you.
Right.
Why do we, as a city, continue to report this bogus story that makes us look like we're a bunch of morons?
Well, it really is, when you say you've grouped us, we as a city, we're independent news organizations have reported it differently. The Post-Dispatch has done it, I think, a fairly good job, at least at this point, in reporting that it's important news because it tarnishes the image of a city. It actually costs people money, even perhaps jobs, even perhaps conventions. So you've got to talk about it. Now, you don't talk about it and say we're the most crime-ridden city, or one of the most crime-ridden cities in the nation, and just leave it at that. You provide context and background. To the extent that other news organizations haven't done that, they've done a disservice to their readers or their listeners or their viewers, and to the city. But it isn't just what's going on in St. Louis; it's what's going on all around the country to all the cities that are on this top 10 list.
Right.
And the fact is that you are more or less safe, really, depending on your neighborhood, and not even the city in which you live. It's a big city.
It's not even the neighborhood. It's also who you know and or who knows you.
Yeah.
Because you're usually killed by somebody who knows you.
Yes, most killings are by people who they know.
I read a story. I forget where it was, but it was a journalistic review or something, and they said that years ago it was much more commonplace that when you had a story, it was imperative to get the opposite point of view within the first two or three paragraphs.
I think that's a useful thing to do. Yeah, somewhere up there high.
Okay.
Present the other side.
And the argument was that journalists today no longer do it. And they put the opposite point of view, or a fact that might debunk whatever the lead of this story is, they bury it in the story to make it more sensationalized. Do you agree with that or disagree?
Well, I see that happening sometimes, but I don't think that's a good journalistic practice. And probably the Poynter Institute would say that as well.
Right. Okay. But you haven't seen that more today than years ago.
You know, I see it more in columns and blogs and other things that we would not consider straight reporting. But really, the most effective commentary takes on the best argument of the other side.
Right.
And often we'll mention it up high, and they'd say, well, you know, I know what you're thinking, that there's this argument against my argument.
Right.
But here's why that argument is specious.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. All right. Alberto Gonzalez is coming to St. Louis.
Yes. This was a story in Student Life in Washington University that the college Republicans want to host Alberto Gonzalez, the departed attorney general, some would say disgraced. And they wanted to bring him to campus. They didn't have quite enough money in the speaker's fund, which I think allows for about $25,000 from the speaker series budget. They needed $35,000 because Alberto's fee is $30,000, and then there's a $5,000 that would be needed for security.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting, maybe this is a man-bites-dog kind of story, is the college Democrats did not oppose it. They would love to have Alberto come to their campus. And I don't know what kind of reception they're preparing for him. So it was not controversial. My observation, though, is that if Alberto Gonzalez had basically done his job and was a good attorney general, or at least moderately good, that nobody would be interested in hearing from him.
Right.
And so this is the what you get for being not so good, so competent.
You know, I have not heard of what Donald Rumsfeld's speaking fee is, but I have.
Oh, must be astronomical.
if you're getting $30,000 for Alberto,
but you know, Rumsfeld probably doesn't ask. Well, probably would not take questions because he asks questions of himself. You know, he said, you know how he did his press conferences. He would say, you know, did I think Iraq would be a disaster? No, and he answers his own questions. So I don't know if that would reduce his speaking fee or not, but he would be very entertaining to listen to as
he
well.
He would be. Alberto Gonzalez, former guest of the show. I think you and I are the only ones who are following this tit-for-tat in the New York Times about Ronald Reagan. This doesn't make any sense to me at all, considering they're talking about something that happened, 27 years ago?
It was, in a way, out of left field, and I'm not quite sure why it got started, but it started a little over a month ago with a Paul Krugman column in which he said that in 1980, Ronald Reagan launched his political campaign with went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was a site of, in many years before, when three civil rights workers were murdered by the Klan. And Ronald Reagan, in 1980, starts his presidential campaign in that city, and he utters the words, states' rights, which many at that time believed was a code word to appeal to racists.
Right.
And I guess Krugman brought it up because he was making the case that the Republican Party had built a majority in the South by appealing to racist sentiments. And lots of people are lionizing Reagan now and claiming his legacy. So Krugman brings it up again. And then David Brooks, his colleague, another columnist who writes Another Day, starts off his column a few weeks later, and he says, "Today I'm going to write about a slur. It's a distortion that's been around for a while." And then he goes on to defend Reagan. He doesn't mention Paul Krugman by name, but then he says at the end of his column, "But still the slur spreads. It's spread by people who, before making one of the most heinous charges imaginable, couldn't even take 10 minutes to look at the evidence." Uh-huh. Now, who's he talking about? Who's he talking about? And then
must be a
Bob Herbert weighs in, another colleague who says, "Oh no, that was a racist campaign thing." And then Krugman comes back and writes something. And then finally, somebody who's not a colleague but a historian, Lou Cannon, has written a column that appeared Sunday that defends Reagan. And so it goes back and forth. It's very interesting and probably not all that relevant to people's everyday lives, but it goes on in the halls of the New York Times.
I will tell you, it must be an interesting Christmas party at the New York Times.
Yes. Hopefully they had a few drinks.
Your former employer, did they retract the mistake, or did they not retract the Britney Spears picture mistake?
Well, if you were paying attention, you may have noticed a little discrepancy in your Sunday paper. There was a little item about Britney Spears and her custody case, and they ran a picture underneath which the word Spears appeared. So you would think that the person in the picture was Britney Spears, but in fact it was a woman who was a lot older, and it was a woman who was featured in a story on page 19A who was deemed by the British Health Service to be too fat to get treatment. And so her picture somehow ended up with the Britney Spears item as well as with her own story. And I would imagine that
at some point
Ms. Spears and this woman would not be pleased if they were aware of that. And so I expected this morning to see a correction. However, there has not been so far. So perhaps no one has brought it to their attention, and we here are doing a public service by doing so.
So what you're saying is that the injustice continues.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. It's sad.
Of all the mistakes, are picture identifications the biggest mistakes newspapers make? Because it seems like there's a number of those.
They happen frequently. My guess is that probably that British story was going to be in the People column. They took out the story and moved it and gave it more space, to their credit, gave it more room, and then they plotched in the Britney column and forgot to replace the picture. That would be my guess. I do not know if that happened, right, but it'll be interesting to see how they phrase the correction.
What is the best story we've never read?
Well, it is a piece in New York Magazine by Jeff Copeland, who's quite a good writer, about a native of St. Louis, Gerald Boyd, who grew up in impoverished circumstances, managed to make his way to the Missouri University School of Journalism, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where he was a terrific a City Hall reporter, among other things, and went to the Washington Bureau, and then rose to become the managing editor of the New York Times, was considered the Jackie Robinson of the New York Times, an African-American, the first African-American to hold that position on the masthead. And then the Jason Blair scandal came along, and Gerald's career went down in flames at that point. And then, sadly, he died of lung cancer about a year ago. And his legacy was somewhat tarnished, many believe, because in the first paragraph of the New York Times obituary, they mentioned the Jason Blair case as if that was what he primarily was known for.
Right.
And in fact, Gerald had a quite a distinguished career. And this piece in New York Magazine is somewhat of a corrective, and but also a very fair and balanced piece about his legacy. The good and the bad. and a very interesting story. And you can find the link on my website, weissreit.com.
Did you work with Gerald Ward?
I did.
Yeah.
I did many years ago, and he was, I think the adjective that I would apply to Gerald was he was fierce. He worked extremely hard. He was not, I wouldn't have called him the best writer in the newsroom, but he was the fiercest journalist that I knew at the time. And he was, we didn't know then, but we figured he was destined for great things. What they would be, we didn't know. And there he was at the New York Times.
He also invented flooding the story, which was something new, I guess, where they would take a story and then write stories from every angle, I guess.
Yes, I think it was within days after Gerald took over that, as managing editor, that 9/11 occurred. And the New York Times won several Pulitzer Prizes off of that. And Gerald was also the editor for what I think is one of the great seminal series in the in American journalism in the last 10 years. It was called Race in America. And they were the most interesting, provocative, and nuanced stories about race in America that I've seen anywhere.
But as great as those Pulitzers were in that story, the biggest blemish on the paper has to be the Jason Blair story.
Right. And things went south at the New York Times over that and over the Judith Miller case,
right.
WMD. And that was in part on Gerald's watch and his boss's watch, Hal Raines, and where the responsibility. Hal Raines was probably got more blame for the things that went wrong at the New York Times than Gerald, and properly so because he was Gerald's boss. But a lot of it deflected to Gerald, and where his responsibility lay was really the subject of this story.
All right, so that's weissreit.com, where you find the story written by the New York Magazine. All right, Dick Weiss, have a good happy Thanksgiving,
and
we'll talk to you next Monday.
Okay.
You got it.